Thanks very much. And thanks very much to RMIT and the organisers of this conference for inviting me to participate in this session. I'm very glad to be here and to share the stage with Dr. Rogers. Looking at the program, I'm seeing a lot of very interesting papers. There's a huge range of housing-related topics being represented. Many of them are well outside the Reserve Bank's remit. But housing as a sector is crucial to a number of our core policy functions. In financial stability, my old role, when I was first invited to give this talk, housing is certainly crucial. Housing is the biggest asset most households will own. It's the bulk of household sector wealth. Lending against housing is also a large part of financial sector assets. Housing outcomes are therefore central to both the welfare of households and the stability of the financial system. The housing sector is also crucial on the monetary policy side, which is my new role. As a sector, it is especially sensitive to interest rate levels. It's a key part of the transmission mechanism of monetary policy. Housing prices respond to interest rates and in turn affect household consumption through wealth effects and collateral effects. And the housing construction industry is probably the most interest sensitive industry in the country. Now, the theme of this conference is housing and inequality. And so what I'd like to do is talk about two aspects of that. And first is the inequality, or rather the diversity between countries, and secondly there's the inequality represented by the distribution of housing outcomes across residents of a particular country. So on the first, we can summarise by saying that institutions matter. Country-specific features are very relevant to housing outcomes, including the outcomes most relevant to both monetary and financial stability policy. A range of institutions determine the idiosyncratic risk that households face and thus the credit risk that they pose to lenders. These include labour market institutions, the funding of healthcare, the structure and generosity of the welfare system, all matter for the financial stability of households. Geographic and other factors determine the urban structure, which in turn affects the relative price of housing. We know from economic geography that as city populations rise and the amenities that go together with that higher population, housing prices rise even relative to the higher incomes that often go with big city living. I probably don't need to tell this audience that. So urban concentration effects affect macro level variables like the ratio of household housing prices to household incomes, as well as individual level outcomes such as people's lifetime housing experiences. The structure of the mortgage market also matters. For example, whether fixed or variable rate mortgages predominate. These features are in turn affected by a range of tax and other institutional factors. As an example of a feature quite specific to Australia is the popularity of linked offset accounts. These change the interpretation of debt data that don't adjust for balances of those accounts. And they also change the assessments of the resilience of the household sector to various kinds of shocks. And this particular feature of a mortgage product is pretty much unique to Australia. So a very crude cross-country comparison can often be misleading. Taken together, these factors suggest that we can't assume that a single value of any particular macro level ratio exists that is right for all countries or for all time. It depends. We can't assume that a particular level of debt is always and everywhere sustainable. It depends on who has the debt and what kind of credit risk they pose. We can't assume that a particular level of prices is correct or sustainable in all circumstances. What we can do is get some sense of the relativities between countries that you might expect. Given those institutional and other differences. For example, we can reasonably expect that countries where much of the population lives in smaller, cheaper cities will have lower national aggregate ratios of housing prices to incomes than other countries. That might partly explain why the price-to-income ratio for the United States is relatively low. By contrast, Australia is somewhere around the middle of the pack of mid-sized countries on this metric, which is probably not the story you sometimes read elsewhere. Similar comparisons of the household debt-to-income ratios across countries also put Australia in the middle of the pack. The United States is lower, consistent with the lower average price-to-income ratios there. Several small European countries, such as Sweden and the Netherlands, have much higher ratios than Australia does. I wouldn't expect or want Australia's ratio to be as high as it is in those countries. Their institutions are different. In particular, a wider range of debt is tax deductible in those countries, so households have less incentive to pay debt down. The concept of inequality, perhaps of most interest to this conference, though, is the differences across households. And the way people access housing is not the same. These distributional issues can be considered across several dimensions. We can consider the distribution of outcomes in the cross-section of households, how outcomes differ for different types of households at a point in time. We can consider outcomes for different cohorts, whether the experience of people in a particular age group changes over time. And we can consider in issues of intergenerational distribution, whether outcomes for people in one generation depend on the experiences of their parents. It turns out that these sort of distributional issues matter for policy. Certainly, they matter for financial stability policy. It's rarely the median borrower who defaults. Risk comes from the tails of the distribution. But even something as macro as the transmission of monetary policy turns out to depend strongly on distributional considerations. So the Reserve Bank spends a lot of time and resources examining household survey data and other micro data to inform our macro understanding. Some of that work has explicitly touched on inequality as the subject of interest, while other work has noted the effect of macro level developments on inequality. The rest of my talk today will cover a few interesting findings from this type of analysis. I'm not setting out to be comprehensive here, because that would not be feasible in the time available, but hopefully it will give you a flavour of what's possible and the kinds of issues that we've looked at. Firstly, and unsurprisingly, housing ownership and housing wealth are not equally distributed across the cross-section of households. Secondly, fewer young people are homeowners now than previous cohorts at the same age. That's partly about demography. If it were purely a story of people being priced out, other outcomes would be different. Finally, concerns about access to appropriate housing aren't only about ownership. We should also think about housing as experienced, including security of tenure. Now, one issue of inequality that generates a lot of public discussion is whether people can purchase their own home. Housing affordability is clearly a concern more generally because adequate shelter is important to human welfare. But clearly there is a great social interest in how that housing is delivered, who owns it, and who pays for it. Of the many inquiries into housing affordability over the past decade or so, at least two, the Productivity Commission's inquiry and the House of Representatives Standing Committee on Economics inquiry in 2003 and then in 2015, were specifically on home ownership. At a national level, Australia actually has a home ownership rate that's neither unusually high nor unusually low. Many of the countries that have higher rates seem to manage it by having very high proportions of young adults living with their parents, even into their 30s, rather than renting. But the outcomes do vary across households, and we can see this in several independently collected data sets. For today, I'm going to rely mainly on the HILDA survey. Now, unsurprisingly, higher income households are more likely to own their own home, whether with a mortgage or outright. The highest income group are not only more likely to live in their own home, the wealth represented by their own home, net of debt, which are the dots, is also higher than for lower income and middle income households. More important than income, though, is life stage. Not many teenagers or young adults are heads of households. Those that are not very likely to own their own home. Over time, people do start purchasing their own home. Home ownership rates rise rapidly with age, reaching about 80% for households headed by someone aged 55 or more. Housing wealth has the same pattern, largely because the older you are, the more time you've had to pay your mortgage debt down. Because higher income households are more likely to be owner-occupiers, they are also more likely to have mortgage debt. That's why we at the Reserve Bank say that mortgage debt in Australia has been borrowed mostly by those most able to service it. That said, the lower income households that do have debt do tend to have quite a lot of debt relative to their incomes. Again, that's the dots in this graph. Sometimes this is because they have temporarily low incomes, but overall it does speak to the need to be aware of pockets of potential stress within a more benign overall picture. Participation in the housing market need not be about owning your own home. Many people rent. Someone else has to own those dwellings as well. And in Australia, most private rental properties are owned by other households rather than, in other words, there are not many companies operating as residential landlords. And so a good indication of who owns rental properties comes from looking at people who have housing debt other than debt on their primary residence. In this graph, we've split up the share of people who have any housing debt into those who have only debt on their own home, the purple bit, and those who have some other kind of housing debt. Most but not all of this second group also have owner-occupier debt. And as you can see, this other property debt is even more likely to be held by high-income earners than owner-occupier debt is. The pattern of rising ownership for older age groups does not give everyone comfort that most people will be able to afford a home eventually. People worry that it's becoming harder to achieve home ownership at a given life stage than it used to be. This would be an issue of inequality across cohorts. It's true that home ownership rates have fallen for most age groups over time. The overall ownership rate has stayed fairly steady because of population ageing. It's also true that ownership rates shifted down between 2006 and 2011. We'll know what happened in 2016 in a couple of months when the census data come out. The 25 to 34 age group is typically seen as the core group of first home buyers. And we can see that ownership rates in this group have fallen by a bit more than 10 percentage points since the 1970s. But we can also see that most of the decline had already happened by the early 1990s, before the big increase in housing prices relative to incomes. What changed during that earlier period was that people started partnering and settling down later in life. The post-war baby boom had been characterised by an anomalously young average age at first marriage. Through the 1970s and 1980s, the normal historical pattern started to reassert itself. Ownership rates for young people declined as a result because many people, quite understandably, wait until they've settled down before they buy a home. By saying this, I'm not suggesting that people should not worry about whether households can achieve their desired housing tenure. I'm suggesting that the situation is more complex than would be suggested by a single-minded focus on a single metric of affordability, such as median house prices. Much of the commentary around the difficulty of achieving home ownership centres on the task of accumulating the deposit. It seems common to assume that everybody needs a 20% deposit when they first buy. This isn't actually true. Although lenders require some deposit coming from genuine savings, it doesn't have to be as high as 20%. So it's quite surprising that as housing prices have risen, the distribution of loan-to-valuation ratios of first-home buyers, the converse of the deposit, hasn't shifted up over time. If anything, it's declined in the past few years for which we have data. It's not entirely clear why this is. And because a high loan-to-valuation ratio does imply higher risk, both for the borrower and the lender, it might not be such a bad thing, particularly for financial stability. But it does suggest that, again, the situation is more complex than a simple summary statistic can capture. And if people were being priced out, maybe they would, by not being able to accumulate a deposit, you have to ask why they're not accumulating smaller deposits when they could if they chose. Now, one reason why first-home buyers haven't needed to increase loan-to-valuation ratios might be that more of them are getting help from friends and family to accumulate the deposit. Careful analysis of the HILDA data survey data set shows that the share of first-home buyers that receiving that help has been increasing over time. But it actually remains low. Look at the scale here. It's less than 15%. It's common to focus on the different outcomes for owners versus renters in purely financial terms. Another aspect of inequality I would like to talk about today is security of tenure. A range of different data sources confirm that although young people move more often than older people, the big difference is between renters and owners. A similar pattern occurs in countries such as the United States. Looking just at the group of households who can be tracked through the whole life of the HILDA survey and who didn't switch between owning and renting at any stage, you can also see that renters were also more likely to have moved many times in the 13-year period. Some earlier literature has suggested that transaction costs induce homeowners to move less often than they might otherwise do, which makes it harder for them to take advantage of labour market opportunities. That effect doesn't seem clear in the Australian data, so I would not draw that conclusion here. Yet even without the transaction costs of selling a home, including tax, legal fees and agent commissions, we know that moving house can be disruptive and costly. So I question whether all those moves by renters were desired by those households. Many renters are happy with their current home, but are required to move because the lease expired or the landlord sold the property. If we're concerned about inequality of housing outcomes, perhaps we should focus less on the type of tenure and more on security of tenure. That's just a brief roundup of some of the issues we've been looking at recently. Housing issues will always be with us and will always be important to the functions of the Reserve Bank. That's why we value conferences like this. The diverse perspectives offered here help us to see the bigger picture. And I'm certainly looking forward to the rest of the discussion in this session. Thank you for your time. Yeah, I guess so.
So thank you, Lucy and Dulles. And now we have the opportunity to take some questions from people in relation to either of the presentations. Would anyone like to start? Okay. Well, I have a question. I was really interested, Lucy, in your analysis of HILDA data, and I've worked with HILDA too, and it's such a fabulous data set. And it occurred to me that in relation to the moving data, that's kind of like a national average, and whether you'd also kind of thought about or looked at, you know, in terms of sort of the variation in terms of rural, urban, regional areas in relation to moving, and whether that was part of the story or not about, you know, the security of tenure issue.
It's fair to say that this is very early days. I had a talk to give and I wanted to look into that particular issue, so some of the team helped me with that analysis. But it is also fair to say that at the Reserve Bank we have a number of different strands of work, including a dedicated team that looks at microdata in our research department. And the use of microdata to facilitate macro analysis is an ongoing project at the RBA.
Yeah, okay, great. Okay, we've got some questions. I might work from the front back, and I'll start over here. Do you need a I'll grab a microphone.
Or
do
we have happy to share.
You're happy to? Yep.
Just a question to Lucy. Thank you.
Maybe just do a brief introduction of who you are, where you're from, and then ask the question. Yep, thank you.
I'm Larry Murphy. I'm from the University of Auckland, New Zealand. I just want to first of all congratulate. This is the presentation. It's excellent. And I want to particularly identify the fact that you've talked about how you calculate certain measures and how they need to be much more flexible and understanding. But if you look at the post-global financial crisis, we look at regulatory authorities around the world, they're increasingly being pushed to address home ownership issues or housing affordability. And the measures they're coming up with are loan-to-value, debt-to-income ratios, and they're applying them in places like the UK and New Zealand and elsewhere. And I'm just wondering, how does your understanding of this kind of fractured awareness of these ratios align with what is actually happening on the ground in macroprudential policies that are clearly impacting the market?
Yeah, so just in case some of the audio didn't come up for the recording, the question was how I what I thought about some of the broader ratios like loan-to-valuation ratios and loan-to-income ratios as a macroprudential tool. And I should point out that macroprudential tools aren't directed at achieving housing affordability. They're directed at achieving financial stability and banking stability. And I think you hit the nail on the head. The fact that some of these ratios are often quite crude and often don't map to how lenders actually think about credit risk is exactly the reason why the Australian authorities are, as has been well documented, quite sceptical about using these sort of blunt tools, you know, except in extremis, that we've been quite sceptical about thinking about lending standards in that way. In the RBA, APRA has quite a multidimensional approach in its prudential practice guide around mortgage lending standards. At the Reserve Bank, we have a sort of five-dimensional framework for thinking about mortgage lending standards that we use. We're not attracted to the idea of going to a particular intermediate target because that feels a lot like monetary targeting in monetary policy, and we know how that worked. So I guess relative to other countries, we've been quite sceptical about the use of those measures, and that's not, I'm not saying anything new there. We've said that many times before.
Charles Waterbed, Family Centre Social Policy Research Unit in Wellington. I was interested in the comment you made about we don't need to just simply focus on home ownership, but I think you said security of tenure or something along those lines. Could you amplify what you mean by security of tenure and how it compares with ownership?
Well, I guess what I was getting at was that, I mean, not everybody is well served by home ownership at every stage in their life. They may actually need to move around for whatever reason. And sometimes that can be compatible with ownership of a home in the sense that you can rent out your, you know, in Australia, you can rent out the home you previously lived in, go and rent somewhere else for a while and then come back. And that's not unheard of. What I'm talking about is essentially people being forced to move when they would have preferred to stay. And that includes, you know, is particularly an issue for renters who often, you know, whose decision to move is often in the hands of someone else. But from a financial stability perspective, it would also refer to people who had previously been homeowners and ended up having to become renters because of financial strains, you know, whether they defaulted on the mortgage or just had to sell because they could no longer support that financial obligation. But I think of it in essentially in those terms.
But wouldn't that require, you know, change in tenancy protection laws, which are, you know, hard to achieve in countries like Australia and New Zealand?
I think that's an interesting conversation to have.
Good point. All right, Peter, did you have a question?
Yeah, Peter Hughes from the University of Sydney. It's a question to Lucy around the nature of sort of new housing supply in different cities in Australia. Coming from Sydney, I'm very struck by the large number of new apartments in Melbourne that are quite geographically constricted in very large buildings and fairly homogenous in their design. And coming from Sydney, I hate to say anything negative about Melbourne, but it's a usual sight to see in Sydney apartments with bedrooms with no windows, for instance, to the outside world. Is that something that, you know, the Reserve Bank would consider in terms of looking at some financial stability risks? You can imagine a second and third sales of some of those apartments, you know, if the market does turn a little bit, could be more difficult to negotiate. Do you get down to that level of detail looking at financial stability risks, I guess, is my question.
Well, that's a question about my previous role, not my current role, but I can tell you that the last 3 years of financial stability reviews have addressed exactly that. I mean, we've been talking about the concentration of apartments, particularly in Melbourne and Brisbane. We're more concerned about that geographical concentration. Yeah, we've been saying that for a number of years. It's all there.
What did you say?
Oh, In the Financial Stability Review and elsewhere, we've been saying there's been this concentration of apartments, particularly in Melbourne and Brisbane. It's geographically concentrated. People need to think about the resale value of that. But the financial stability angle of this, and I'd refer to a box that was in the October, the FSR in October last year, the financial stability angle of that in terms of the blowback to the financial system and then onwards to the household sector is actually through lending to developers, not through lending to households. If you think about the relative loss rates, that's really the vector of transmission of financial instability. But we have been highlighting for at least 3 years our concerns about the concentration, the geographic concentrations within cities and the absolute size of apartment supply in Melbourne and Brisbane relative to the existing housing stock in those areas. And in fact, you're seeing it now. I mean, Brisbane apartment prices are falling. Why, you know, there was more supply coming online than there had been underlying population demand for it. In some sense, Melbourne's population is growing so quickly, it's less of a concern. And secondly, with Sydney, again, population is growing quite quickly, lots of overseas migration, people have to live somewhere, and it's more dispersed across the city. There has been a lot of housing supply in recent times, and what matters, again, is how it's distributed. And we've absolutely been talking about this for the last 3 or 4 years in the Financial Stability Review. But that's my old job.
Okay. Peter, was your question also a little bit about quality of dwelling?
Yep. That certainly strikes me as a consideration, looking at, you know, the difference in dislocation, but also, you know, the nature of the stock that might be less resilient from a more discriminating purchaser in a declining market.
Yeah, and that's definitely something I think in one of the 2013 financial stability reviews we discussed the potential resale value of some of that property and how adaptable it is to different market segments of demand. So, you know, if it's very specific in its appeal, that can matter. But again, you know, how that blows back on the rest of the economy is through losses by developers and then on to the people who lent to those developers. That the analysis we've done is that's unlikely to cause widespread household distress.
Okay. Question here?
Lucy, my name is Julie Lawson. I'm interested in, you made a comment in the beginning that institutions matter, so the cities are very important. And one of them, of course, is the welfare system.
Yes.
So if you imagine, as we heard from Peter Ronald, that generation rent and the prospects for long-term renting, even if it is insecure, would imply that in post-employment retirement or reliance on the old age pension, that it would draw very heavily, necessarily, on some form of rent assistance, which we don't have in our wage earners, homeowner welfare system. So does the Reserve Bank consider those kind of long-term implications and what that implication would have for demands on that, necessarily demands on the welfare system?
I mean, it's not within our remit to opine specifically on the design of the welfare system, but what we have said publicly before is that the way the welfare system in Australia is designed is that essentially as long as you own a home outright by the point you retire, that's kind of the goal of the own, you know, that's in some ways the ownership goal that's been framed by the design of the welfare system. And it's not obvious to us that there's a specific public policy imperative to ensure that that ownership starts at a particular early stage in your life, as long as when you get to retirement, you are not relying on private rental. And I mean, obviously, clearly some people in on the age pension are relying on private rental, and I think that's an important issue for those arms of government with that remit. But yeah, that's certainly something that we've observed in the past, you know, given our current design. And that's the thing, it's all connected. You know, the design of our welfare system has the implications for how we frame the public policy goal in the housing space. It also has implications for how we think about the idiosyncratic risk posed by households. And you know, this is an important thing, again, in cross-country comparisons. You know, there's a lot of assumptions in sort of international debate and indeed in international regulatory standard setting that a household sector in one country with mortgages poses the same risk as a household sector in another country. And of course, it's a very difficult conversation to say, well, our households are less risky than yours because X, Y, and Z, when you really don't want countries gaming the system against each other and using the regulatory system for competitive advantage. And so that's, you know, some of the fun and games that happens in the sort of the international policy conversations, which I'm no longer involved in.
Jago?
This is a question for Lucy. You've obviously hinted at an appreciation within the Reserve Bank that inequality is a question that needs to be considered in these kind of conversations. But I wonder if you could tell us a little bit more to what extent in terms of your financial stability models that you operate to understand the national economy and what issues that relate to your role as regulators. Does inequality have a presence in either the conceptual framework around financial stability or in the actual technical models that you apply to measure the state of financial stability at any given moment in time?
I think the word I'd use to frame it is distribution. And for example, you know, one of the publications that has been done coming out of that work was the sort of household stress testing models, again, actually using the HILDA data. So, you know, one of the things you can do is come up with a micro-simulation model of the, you know, how individual households fare under certain stress scenarios based on their current balance sheet and income and labour force participation and so on. And that's a really important input into getting loss loss ratios for a broader stress testing model. They're the sort of, and I mean, that's the sort of thing you have to do when you haven't had a recession for over 25 years. That's a material recession. We've had small downturns, but we haven't had a full-blown recession. And so that means we don't have very good data to put in stress testing models. That's like the silver, every silver lining has a cloud. But that's one of the things we do. And obviously, the distribution matters there. And so any kind of stress testing model has that. So on the financial stability side, that would be kind of the way we'd frame it. And certainly there have been, things where we publish, the share of households who meet certain criteria and therefore in distress. And indeed, the share of businesses who meet certain criteria and therefore might be considered more vulnerable. On the monetary policy side, as I mentioned, actually understanding the cash flow channel of monetary policy and the collateral effects of changes in interest rates really do depend on the distribution. So in that sense, it's not like you have a Gini coefficient on the right-hand side of your regression, but those distributional considerations absolutely do aggregate up. I guess what I'm saying is that the representative agent model really doesn't work for us as well as some people might think.
Okay.
Michael Levy from the Australian Financial Review. Two questions to you, Lucy, I have to make. You referred to falling apartment prices in Brisbane as a result of rate supply. Mm. To your mind, is that a sign of some healthy readjustment in the housing supply equation? And is it a sign that the system is sort of working the way it should?
Well, I think the way I'd frame it is that yes, if you have a lot more supply coming on very suddenly, prices will be lower than they otherwise would be. And you do also see that a little bit in the wedge between growth in apartment prices and housing prices in Melbourne, although apartment prices are still rising. Supply and demand both do matter. I think, would I regard it as healthy? I think people need to, again, the reasons why, in my previous role, we were expressing so many concerns about Brisbane apartments is the concentration, and that there are issues. When you have building lags, you can end up with a situation where you've got a lot of supply coming online that where the decisions to build were made a couple of years ago, where the decisions to buy were made a couple of years ago, and then you end up getting caught out on the other side. And so there are risks to when you have big surges of building activity, and you can have too much of a good thing in some sense, and you can have too concentrated a good thing. So there are there are important nuances to be aware of in this debate. And I think one of the points I made in my talk is that things are a little bit more nuanced than just sort of little slogans of price to income ratio says this, or all supply is good, or supply now is just as good as supply spread out. We need to be aware of those nuances and those risks, and that's the point I'm making.
Okay. At the risk of asking another less nuanced question, but one again about housing supply, there's the report today that the federal government is considering reducing the capital gains tax deductions on property investment. Mm. What effect, as a top line, would that have, do you think, on housing supply? And secondly, what effect could it have if it had it limited in property? Simply have the risk of inflating prices of other asset classes?
Well, firstly, since that has just been announced that they're considering it, we have not done detailed modelling of that. Even if we could, but I can refer you to the statement I made to the House of Economics inquiry on home ownership in 2015, where we talked at length about tax and how that the tax system and how that related to home ownership. And what we said at the time was that it's the interaction between negative gearing and the capital gains tax discount that create this incentive to leverage into investor housing. in Australia, and it goes particularly into investor housing because property is the asset you can leverage the most, so that's where the incentive is most attractive. So it would stand to reason that if you reduce the capital gains discount, that incentive to gear up into housing would be less than it were otherwise. So obviously I haven't had a chance to do that detailed modelling in the time available, but it's certainly something worth looking at.
Thank you.